And when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. When he drew near to Bethphage and Bethany, at the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of the disciples, saying, "Go into the village in front of you, where on entering you will find a colt tied, on which no one has ever yet sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' you shall say this: 'The Lord has need of it.'" So those who were sent went away and found it just as he had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owner said to them, "Why are you untying the colt?" And they said, "The Lord has need of it." And when they brought it to Jesus, and throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. And as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." He answered, "I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out." And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, "Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that would make for peace. But now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children with you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation."
I don't know if you've ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect. I'm sure it's just common conversation in your households. It was coined in 1999 by two Cornell University psychologists, David Dunning and Justin Kruger. Essentially, this is what it means. I'm going to read it so I don't get it wrong. It means a state of cluelessness whereby people who are incompetent at something are unable to recognize their own incompetence. That's obvious, right? Because obviously if they're incompetent, they don't want to be incompetent. They don't recognize it, right? But they're also likely to feel confident that they are actually competent. So it goes way beyond just being incompetent. It's feeling competent at something. So according to David Dunning, the irony of the Dunning-Kruger effect is that the knowledge and intelligence that are required to be good at a task are often the same qualities needed to recognize that one is not good at the task. And if one lacks such knowledge and intelligence, one remains ignorant that one is not good at that task. Well, we know people like this, right? Not us, of course. We're all competent in all that we do. You know, they've done surveys about in the United States, and about 98% think they're above average. Well, the Dunning-Kruger effect is alive and well, right? I think you know that this is true. Have you ever seen American Idol? And you get somebody who can barely croak out a tune, and they cut them, and then they're just furious, and they say, "They'll see, they're gonna regret this when I make it to the top." And everybody's, of course, laughing because they're not gonna make it to the top or anything like that. That's the Dunning-Kruger effect. So why would I tell you this? Here it is. The issue is not that we're incompetent spiritually, which we are, by the way, we are, but the issue is that we don't realize it. So often we don't realize it. So we live powerless, prayerless, self-reliant lives that fit right into the plan of the enemy for us. And so life quite often is about a therapeutic approach that has as its goal to try to feel good about ourselves. We do the things that we do to try to feel good about ourselves. And it feels a lot like the Dunning-Kruger effect, ignoring the reality of things, the reality of the depth of the things, and running to God for answers and trying to just feel good about myself, maybe raise my self-esteem somehow. But the Bible, of course, is brutally honest. If we will let it be, it tells us the honest truth about God. It tells us the honest truth about us, and it tells us about grace, about Jesus' sacrifice for us. This is the Bible. Not so that we will have this therapeutic feel-good sense, but so that we might have transformation. That's the goal of the Bible. It's to kill the old person and to raise to life the new, right? That's what the Bible does. A new identity, a new trust, guilt gone, the life of Jesus becomes our life. This is the goal of the Bible. But it's hard to see because everybody has an agenda. That's why I called this sermon Agendified. I haven't heard that word before. Maybe somebody else has said that. So I'm going to claim it. I'm coining that term. Feel free to use it at parties. It's a good one. We're agendified. Everybody has an agenda. And so it's hard to see what God is doing. So in our story today of the triumphal entry, I promise it was coming to a point. The triumphal entry, we have at least three different groups of people, each one with their own biases, each one with their own agendas, and they view this whole event differently based on their biases and their agendas. They're actually huge blind spots, right? And then we have Jesus. So we're going to look at these four things, and here they are. The multitudes, number one. Number two, the disciples. Number three, the Pharisees, and number four, Jesus. So these are four different agendas, four different perspectives, four different expectations of what's going on in this story. The multitudes, the disciples, the Pharisees, and Jesus. Let's look at the multitudes. So if you put the four gospels together, we find out that Jesus had come to Bethany. And I should have gotten a map out for you, but Bethany is really on the Mount of Olives. So if we're looking this way, here's the map, right? Here's Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives is to the east. And Bethany is 2 miles from the crest of the Mount of Olives. Should I just keep going this way? Would this help? All right. It's just over there, over the hill, about 2 miles from Jerusalem. Well, why did Jesus arrive there? Well, it was the place where Mary, Martha, and Lazarus lived. And he had raised Lazarus from the dead, so he was back. You remember, we looked at last week, Jesus has turned his face towards Jerusalem. Well, he's almost there. He's almost there. So he stops at their house. Well, people got wind of this, and they showed up in Bethany, not just to see Jesus. He's really famous by this time. Not just to see Jesus, but to see Lazarus, who had been raised from the dead. And so multitudes were coming out there to Bethany. And so when Jesus begins his trek, and we'll talk about the disciples and the donkey and all that stuff, but when Jesus begins his trek on the back of this donkey toward Jerusalem, the multitudes went with him, and many more came out of Jerusalem and met him up on the Mount of Olives. And they met him and they cried out, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Okay, these are significant words. They have an agenda. They have an agenda. They spread their coats on the road, and though it's not in the Luke account, they wave their palm fronds. That's a cool word, isn't it? I've just learned that recently. A frond. Is that a normal word? Can everybody say it together? A frond. Yeah, palm frond that they were doing that with. And here's the thing about the frond, the palms. When Israel had been at peace, when they had their own kingdom and they had their own money, one of the symbols on one of the coins was a palm frond, because it had to do with the king. The money was backed by the treasury of the king. So these are all kingly significances, if you can say it like that. They were all about a Messiah, a deliverer, a conquering king. So Jesus, as I said, was extremely famous in Israel at this time. They knew his power. He'd given them food. He'd calmed the storms. He'd healed diseases. He'd cast out demons. And now he's descending the Mount of Olives on this donkey, and the people are screaming. The moment must be here. This is it. People are streaming out from Jerusalem. The crowds are coming. Here's the king. And the prophecy is that the king would come from the east, exactly where he was coming from, down the Mount of Olives and through the Kidron Valley, and he would be going into Jerusalem. This is what was predicted by the prophets. See, their expectation from the Old Testament prophecies was that an earthly king would come and take over in Jerusalem and give them peace, and their enemies would be defeated, their borders would be expanded. It was a complete misunderstanding because Jesus wasn't doing that at all. So they had their agenda. This is what they were going to do. They had their expectations. This is it. It looks like we're about to have a coronation. But Jesus wasn't doing that at all. In fact, you could argue that Jesus was doing this just to rile up the religious leaders. He just wanted to make them mad so that their hate would reach a fever pitch and they would do everything in their power to get rid of him, which is in fact exactly what they did, right? That's exactly what happened. Jesus' agenda won. So here's my question for you. What are your expectations of Jesus? Jesus told Pilate that his kingdom was not of this world. Perhaps your expectations in life are for Jesus to make things good right now. Ease, happiness, and fun. Isn't this what we tell our kids every time we see them when they went to some activity? Did you have fun? Very quickly, our kids get the idea that life is about fun. And if it's not fun, it wasn't worth living. Maybe not that strong, but you know what I'm saying. It's about fun. This is the thing we talk about all the time. And here's the thing. The Israelites were saying all the right words. Blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. And that was actually true. They were saying words that were true. But they had the wrong expectations. They had no idea what Jesus was actually doing. That's the multitudes. Number two, the disciples. The disciples should have known better. They've been hearing it now for years. Jesus told them for years what he was doing. Jesus knew what was going to happen. And he had two of them go into the village and get that donkey that was tied there. Verses 30 to 35, you can read about it. I thought about reading it, but it's already too long, so I'm not going to read it. Verses 30 to 35, they brought it to Jesus. They put their cloaks on this animal, and they began their march toward Jerusalem. And when the disciples, I'm sure when they saw the crowds and their excitement must have been mounting, they actually had similar expectations to the crowd. Very similar expectations, except theirs were way more because they had elevated expectations, right? But there were always some weird things with Jesus. Why a donkey? Why wasn't it a horse? But all along the way, there had been things that didn't fit their expectations. They really had no idea what Jesus was doing, but they thought they did. So this is probably a lesson for us, brothers and sisters. They'd lived with Jesus for 3 years, and they thought they knew what he was doing, and they had no idea. And here's the lesson. If you think you know what Jesus is doing, you probably don't. You probably don't. So his thinking is always about the kingdom and the good of that kingdom and its inhabitants. But this is where the Dunning-Kruger effect comes in. We think we know what is good for us. We pursue those things with much energy, but truth be told, we often don't know what's good for us at all. We don't know what's good for us at all. So Jesus had told his disciples many times that he would be crucified. But since that didn't compute with them into their paradigm of what Jesus was doing, they just simply dismissed it. He told them over and over and over again, I will go to Jerusalem and I'll be handed over to the chief priests and they will put me to death. He told them over and over and it never, never computed. Just like getting a donkey instead of a horse didn't compute into their paradigm. They were expecting great things. They were expecting him to come set himself up, and they're thinking this is the time too. But see, they have way bigger expectations because they're in the inner circle. They're going to rule and reign with him. They're going to get all this responsibility, but much more importantly, all this authority to be able to do things and get served by people. You know, really, it was about them. You remember when they were in Samaria and the Samaritans rejected Jesus and the two disciples said, should we call down fire from heaven? It was clearly about the disciples. And this is the moment. All these crowds, they just don't know, but they will be bowing down to us. And this is happening right now. Blessed be the King. Little did they know that within a week, they would be devastated and scattered, and life as they had known it would be over because Jesus would be dead. Inconceivable on this day. The cold, hard reality would settle in. Everything they thought that the triumphal entry was would be shattered. What a letdown. What do you do when the cold, hard reality sets in? That you didn't get what you thought Jesus was going to give you. When your expectations and even your agenda are shattered, what do you do? Do you question your faith? Do you get disappointed or angry with Jesus and think that he's let you down? Maybe, like the disciples, it's just that your expectations are wrong. That you had an agenda the whole time, but it wasn't Jesus' agenda at all. But here's the thing about Jesus' agenda. The promises are still true, and God is still good all the time. That's what the Bible tells us. Just because he didn't fulfill my agenda doesn't mean he's not good. Number three, the Pharisees. They were a conservative religious sect in Israel. They were actually highly respected because they were very earnest in their desire to obey the law. They considered themselves the good people in their society. No one loved the law, or at least externally loved the law like they did, and no one obeyed the law like they did-ish, or at least in their minds. They considered themselves as those who were the closest to God. They fasted regularly and engaged in religious ritual religiously. They were the most pious group in all of Israel. They were serious about God. And yet Jesus lambasted them. Consider this passage in Matthew 23. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe what they tell you, but not the works they do. For they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long, and they love the place of honor at feasts and the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others. So they gave the appearance that they followed the law, but they actually didn't. Isn't this the way it is with religious people? The most religious people are often the most angry because they feel like they are getting it right and no one else is. It's just actually the Dunning-Kruger effect. All it means is that it's a show. It's external conformity with no heart obedience. And so it's no surprise that they are furious on this day. When the people are screaming, "Blessed is the King," the Pharisees say to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." Jesus couldn't possibly be the King. He couldn't possibly be the Messiah. That is a non-starter for the Pharisees. And these people are declaring blasphemy. Jesus threatened to undo everything they held as sacred. And so they were so angry with him. They must do away with him. But this screaming from the crowd was the ultimate in that blasphemy. And it had to stop. See, they thought they knew God, but here he was right in front of them, and they didn't even recognize him. Have you recognized him? What are your expectations of Jesus? Maybe you think he demands too much. He wants you to die to yourself, to admit your spiritual bankruptcy, to throw yourself on him in faith, knowing that he's the only hope we have. Does that sound like too much? Because in addition, he asks you to put him first in everything, to prioritize his lordship in everything, to give him your time and your money and everything you are for the sake of the kingdom. Does that sound like too much? That's a lot. So this is the call of Jesus. How are we doing with that? The Pharisees didn't see it, and I think we often don't see it either. They were not law keepers, and neither are we, and we certainly need grace. So how does he respond to the Pharisees? He says, "I tell you, if these were silent, the people, if they were silent, the very stones would cry out. Even the rocks, if it were possible, know who Jesus is, for they were created by him." Those verses that say the mountains and the trees will burst forth into singing, and the mountains will burst forth into singing, and the trees will clap their hands. I gotta believe that's gonna happen. And that the rocks are gonna cry out, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." This is all his creation. He can do whatever he wants with it. I don't have any evidence of that, so don't quote me on it, but I like to think that that would be the case. See, the Pharisees think they're good at religion, but they don't even know that their practice is further away from God than even the multitudes that misunderstood him, because they were directly hostile to God himself, who was right in front of their eyes. So number four is Jesus. And this is very moving. Verse 41 says, "And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, 'What would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes.'" Jesus knows how clueless they all are. They're all agendified, each with his own agenda. He sees us with our own agendas. And what is his reaction? Is it wrath and judgment? No. He weeps. He weeps. You would think he'd be drinking in the praise, but he's not, because they have all gotten it wrong. He weeps. So we don't know exactly where Jesus was on the Mount of Olives when he did this. There's a church about halfway down the Mount of Olives, and they say that's where it was, but the truth be told, they built churches over every single square inch of that place over there, and I don't necessarily buy it. I did include a picture. Can you click on that picture? On the there you go. Look at this. So this is from the top of the Mount of Olives. Okay, this is the top of the Mount of Olives, looking at Jerusalem. You can see the Dome of the Rock, which is that mosque on the Temple Mount. All those the trees there is that's the Temple Mount, and you know, obviously there's all the modern buildings behind, but this is old Jerusalem in the foreground. And this is, Jesus would have been looking at a much smaller Jerusalem, but this is the view he would have had of Jerusalem as he came over the mountains. And he sees it and he weeps, right? He weeps. Why is he weeping? Because he sees this Jerusalem and he knows that within, you can take that off now, that within 40 years, it will be destroyed completely. The Romans will destroy the city. And it's God that allows this destruction because they had completely rejected him. He's weeping because they reject him. They were expecting a political fulfillment, but that wasn't going to be Jesus' way at all. In his book, The Savior of the World, M. Wilcox says this, "The kingdom centers on the cross. He turns our attention away from the political transformation of society to the spiritual transformation of the soul, which must precede it. The kingdom must first come to the human heart." If we ever expect any change to happen in our dear nation, it won't happen in the political process. It has to be hearts. It has to be one heart at a time where the gospel comes. But even though Jesus knows what he's doing and his act of sacrifice would be the one that would begin to change hearts, even though he does all that, he weeps. He weeps for the people that won't follow his agenda because it is to their peril that they won't follow. It's to their peril. This is why he came into the, had to come into the world, to go to the cross so those who would believe on him would come into his kingdom and be his kingdom agents and one day live and rule and reign with him forever. That's why he came. Is it possible that we might have misunderstood the kingdom? I think of our political season right now. I find that most people align themselves with one party or another party. Sometimes people align themselves with one party and they're not totally happy with everything in that party, but they know they hate the other party. And so that's where they are. And you know that we have that massive divide in our country. The two parties, nobody can even talk to one another or not very well. Here's the thing about Christianity. It doesn't align itself with a party. It's not political in the sense that it has coercive external force to accomplish its goal. It's actually over. Jesus sits over politics, culture, you name it. He's the real truth. Everything else is in flux. So he sits over it. And his agenda that we have in the Bible sits over all of it. Over the whole thing. So it doesn't mean that the kingdom doesn't have power and that it doesn't speak into issues because it speaks into every issue. The gospel speaks into every issue. Think about it. It might be unexpected, but it has issues that might be considered conservative issues. The Bible has conservative things it stands for, but the Bible also has things that are traditionally associated with liberals that it stands for as well. Let me go through a couple of these things. Take abortion, for example. The rhetoric of the day is that this is about women's health care, and no one should be able to tell a woman what to do with her body. I totally agree with that. I actually believe in women's health care, and I believe that a woman should be able to do, nobody should tell her what she can do with her body. There's just a little problem here, and it's not that little. The little baby in her womb is by definition not her body. It's not her body. It's a separate body. And what I want to know is who speaks? Who speaks for the baby? That's always forgotten in the discussion. And neither party is getting this right. Who speaks for the baby? Well, God does. You knit me in my mother's womb. We're pro-life because God is. And it's not our agenda, it's His. And Jesus weeps. He weeps. Do we? Think about the sexual revolution. The common belief is that sex is no more, the modern day vision is that sex is no more than an appetite to satisfy. So anything goes in a relationship. You can do whatever you want. The saying is, as long as there are two consenting adults, then anything goes. But it's actually not true. There's so much pain and heartache that has happened because of this kind of approach. I could go into it way more, but I don't have time. But Jesus weeps. There's no flourishing in that. Do we? Most people think that Christians are against homosexuality and the transgender movement because they're full of hate. And all they want to do is bring prudish rules on everyone else. And we have no right to tell anyone what to do. And I can see how it seems that way. I can see how it seems that way. But what we're saying is, what Christianity is saying is that God knows what's best for all of us. He knows what flourishing is and what will make us flourish in His word. He definitely says that these things do not produce flourishing. So it's hardly hate that motivates us to be against homosexuality and transgenderism. It's actually love. Because we believe from the bottom of our souls that God's agenda and God's way will bring flourishing. You see, Jesus speaks into these issues. It's not really a political agenda for us. It's a love agenda. And Jesus weeps. Do we? Do we? But then there are other issues, right? The Bible speaks of justice and mercy. It speaks of helping the needy and the oppressed. It speaks about racism. It tells us to let justice roll down like rivers, as we saw in Amos. It says that He has shown us how to live, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. These are not political issues, really, because both sides are getting this wrong. Both sides have adopted unbiblical stances on this. They're biblical issues, that when there's injustice for some, there's injustice for all. That when there is no peace for some, there's no peace for all. Justice and mercy are actually pro-life issues. We want life for the unborn, but we want life for the oppressed. And we want life and freedom for everyone. It's actually an outworking of the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. Jeremiah 29 tells us to seek the peace of the city. And so we're to infiltrate and promote flourishing wherever we go. And Jesus weeps over injustice. Do we? Here's the real issue. Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. But once we see that Jesus is the way, then we lose our identity. It's not our agenda anymore. We gain His identity and we get His agenda. This is what Christians do. They follow His agenda, whether we understand it or not, whether we think it's a great idea or not. And today, it's hard to follow that agenda in many, many ways. It may look like the hard way or the counterintuitive way, but it's actually the way of rest, and it's the way of flourishing, and it's the way of peace. We can't reinvent Christianity. Doesn't matter what people do to us. The King of the universe loves us, and so we follow Him, trusting not in our own understanding, as everyone around us is doing, but we trust in Him, and we trust in His word, and we weep for those who don't know Him. And why wouldn't we trust Him, brothers and sisters? The one that came down that mountain could have avoided the cross and set Himself up as king in Jerusalem just by saying the word. He already was the king, but He didn't. He not only let the Pharisees get mad because he let the people scream, "Blessed is the king," but he also went into the temple and he turned over all the money, the tables of the money changers and all those things. You don't think he was trying to get some ire up there? He really shook up the religious establishment, but he did it so that they would crucify him. He knew that it was the only way for you and I to get out of our own self-deception and see the truth about the world. There really is a kingdom. There really is a king. There really is life after death. There really is a Savior that loves us and gave himself for us. There really is an eternity where he invites us to live in perfect peace. There really is forgiveness. There really is such a thing as flourishing. It's all true. Why wouldn't we make his agenda, our agenda, even when it's unpopular? What is your agenda? That's the gospel, and it changes everything. It really does. Let's pray.